In the time of the New Testament, they had quotations, but they didn't have quotation marks. Quotation marks are things that begin around the 16th century. And when they first begin, you can see them in English. Some of you are going to say they're back in Hittite already. Okay, yeah, I'm talking about English for a moment. And what we see is that they are often in the left-hand margin and they keep the quotation open. And what you don't have is then the closing out. It's marking the whole of that area as quotation. But one of the things that's happened just in the last 100 years is that people have started introducing speech marks into English Bibles. And you may not read any of these other languages, but if you open up a Bible in Arabic, you'll often find they have quotation marks that look rather like ours. And in Chinese and Japanese, quotation marks that look rather like ours. And you start saying, wow, what's happened? The infection is spreading. Now, one of the things about quotation marks is they create two brand new rules. Because what they say is this is an uninterruptible quotation, and there are two new rules. Between these bounds of the bounded quotation, you can't insert a word without breaking off the quotation and showing that you're inserting or a bracket or something like that. You also can't miss anything out. Now imagine someone a couple of thousand years ago, let's say, has a 20-word sequence, and we try and represent that, but we can only remember 19 of the 20 words in our speech system. Then we are going to have to close off the quotation and then reopen it or something. Or if we can only remember half of the words, we're going to go in and out of quotation marks all the time. Or the other thing you can do is paraphrase completely so that no one can accuse you of plagiarizing. And that's part of the constraint of our stupid system of attribution. And I do think it's got some positives, but it's also got a lot of negatives. And when we're dealing with what is true quotation, we've got to recognize that back in the time of the New Testament, they don't have bounded quotation systems. Now, that doesn't mean they can't quote verbatim. They know how verbatim works, but it means that that is not the only true way of quoting. So when we look at the Gospels and we see that, say, Matthew and Mark are reporting what seems to be the same incident and they have slightly different wordings attributed to Jesus, we don't say, oh no, what a terrible thing. Because although by our contemporary rules, it might be important for them to be absolutely identical, they are not bound by our rules, they are bound by their rules. Now, when we see the references in the New Testament, we see that Jesus is presented as a teacher. There are 195 references to disciples, 45 times that Jesus teaches, 40 times he is called teacher, 12 times he's called rabbi, and the age is often depicted as the Tanaitic age. Tana, Aramaic for to repeat. It's the age where you repeat what your master said to you. And I think all of this creates a context in which when we're looking at the question, can we have the exact words of Jesus? We've got to remember Jesus had 12 students, and those students had, you had one job. You've seen those, you know, GIFs or whatever it is out there. You had one job. They have one job, which is to learn what their master is teaching. And you can sometimes see them repeating over and discussing amongst themselves what actually he's just taught. Now, we also find that an itinerant speaker reuses material. I would say, you know, having spoken in many different places, you know, I think one version of a talk relating to names, I've probably given 60 or more times, and, you know, it's all slightly different each time. Now, is Jesus supposed to create a new sermon to every village he goes to as he sends out his disciples to preach? Are they meant to come up with a new sermon every time? Well, what we find is the Gospels often report Jesus saying the same thing more than once. So in Matthew, you would have to the one who's given, more will be given. I know people don't like this. They think it's all the wrong way around, but this is what it says, not just in chapter 13, but also in chapter 25. Mark has it, and Luke has it twice. In Luke, you also have repeated sayings. In Mark, you have let him who has ears to hear repeated. In John, Jesus says, I am the door, more than once. You have all sorts of repetitions that come up. So, in order to take the testimony of the gospel seriously, we've got to say Jesus sometimes repeated teaching. And so Jesus sometimes repeated teaching, and he has disciples who have got to learn what he says. Now, one of the interesting things we find when we look at speech in the Gospels is that on the whole, the Gospels agree far more when it is quotation of speech, whether of Jesus or of John the Baptist and so on. Well, people might say, well, that's because of Q, isn't it? Q, the hypothetical source behind Matthew and Luke, shared material that's really sayings. Well, yes, but that won't explain why it's also happening in the resurrection narratives, which aren't supposed to be part of Q. So take a famous passage like Mark chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, you know, the man being let down through the roof. What we can do is we can divide that into the first seven verses, 101 words in the Greek of Mark. Then we've got the next four verses, 73 words, 62 of which belong to Jesus, are quoted from him. And then we have the ending, which is just 22 words. And we look at the way Matthew, Mark, and Luke relate at this point. And what we see is at the point where they're quoting Jesus' words, they suddenly get a lot closer. This is something Ita Linneman showed in her book, Is There a Synoptic Problem? Or we look at what has been shown with the words in the resurrection narratives here, working after N.T. Wright, where we know the resurrection narratives are really quite different, aren't they? Matthew, Mark, and Luke just here, and John, of course, very different as well. So we look at the number of words there are in these verses, and we have, say, 130, 120, and we say, how many of these words actually agree between Luke and Mark? How many of these words agree between Mark and Matthew, and so on? The answer is not very many. But then let's look at some particular bits of speech within the narrative. And suddenly we find them getting closer. So here we have Mark 28, 5 to 6, paralleled against, Matthew against Mark 16, verse 6. Now, the first bit that I've laid out in italics is the introduction to the speech. But the angel answered and said to the women, that's in Matthew, and he said to them. So it's not quoting speech there. But then we have, as it gets into the speech, they get closer. Do not be afraid in Matthew, do not be alarmed in Mark. Then we have, for I know that in Matthew, but nothing in Mark. But then, of course, if you don't have the idea that you're not allowed to omit something without saying, that isn't a problem. Then we've got in Matthew, you see Jesus who was crucified. And in Mark, you have, you see Jesus, the Nazarene who was crucified. So all you've got is an extra bit in Mark. But then again, there's no problem with omitting a bit in one account. Then we have, he's not here for he has risen. And in Matthew, but in Mark, the reverse order, he has risen, he's not here. Matthew, as he said, then come, see the place where he lay. And the other say, see the place where they laid him. Now, the come again is just an omission or not. We can see that suddenly when we're getting to quotation of speech, we're getting a lot closer. Now let's run Matthew against Luke. These are a little bit more different than Matthew and Mark, but we still get the same idea. So the introduction, but the angel answered and said to him, said to the women, and in Luke, they said to him. In Matthew, do not be afraid, nothing in Luke. But then we have, for I know that you seek Jesus who is crucified. And in Luke, we suddenly go, why are you seeking, the same verb as we have in Matthew, seek, the living among the dead? And it's very interesting that there is a semantic link between who was crucified and the living and the dead, isn't there? I mean, there's something going on there. Then we have what's called a minor agreement, where the order in Matthew and Luke is identical. He is not here for he has risen. He is not here, but he has risen. So in other words, at this point, you know, you normally expect Matthew and Mark might go together, but at this point, Matthew and Luke are going together on that order, as he said, and then come see the place where he lay, and in Luke it's rather different as it ends off, remember how he told you. Now, it looks to me like what we have, and this is something that you can trace throughout the Gospels, and I'd love some of you number crunchers to really do some more digging down on this, but what we have is basically whenever we have speech, and it doesn't matter who the character is, the Gospels are getting closer. And it seems to me that we can make a case, therefore, what's going on is they're drawing from a well of memory of what Jesus said. I'll give you another example. This is in my book, not original to me, but how in Matthew's gospel, Jesus prays in the garden, and it's only in Matthew that he says this, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. It's an unusual phrase. It's a striking phrase. What on earth is the cup? You can go into Jeremiah 25 background, but it's striking. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And then in John, and only in John, when they come to arrest Jesus in the garden, i.e. what would be a short time later, he bizarrely turns to Peter and says, shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? And you're looking through John and thinking, well, what's this stuff about cup? But of course, if he was actually thinking about cup at the time, suddenly you can explain why there is that hit. Another one, again, between Matthew and John. And it's important because I think often people don't treat Matthew as having the same credentials of reliability as some of the other ones. The resurrection accounts in Matthew and John are so different, aren't they? You know, in Matthew, the angel comes down, scares the guards, you know, dead and then off. And then they run off, sits down on the stone. Along come the women, you know, amazed at this. He delivers a message to them after giving them a bit of a tour. And then they run off and they see Jesus. In John, it's completely different, isn't it? Mary goes alone. Well, you're like, you think it's alone, except she comes back and tells the disciples, we don't know where they laid him. But anyway, she just sees the stone rolled away, but doesn't go in. She goes back, then two of the other disciples run off, then she somehow has joined them. And then that's the point at which she sees the angels in the tomb, and then finally turns around and sees the gardener, who happens to be Jesus. And this is what happens. In Matthew, the women running away from the tomb met Jesus. He said, rejoice, he said, and they came and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid, but go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and they will see me. Now, this is an unusual expression, which does not seem to be literal brothers, that the disciples are getting called brothers. And then we look in John, and Jesus is saying, do not cling on to me, which implies touch to Mary. For I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father. When you have the same Father, your brothers, you see? There's a logic there. So what we find is the Gospels agree on the big thing that Jesus rose from the dead. They have all sorts of differences at the middle level in these accounts. And then at the tiny level, bam, they suddenly fit, which is exactly what I'd expect if we have independent true reports, at least six women going to the tomb, but they don't all move simultaneously into tombs and out of tombs and so on. Therefore, they see slightly different things. They report slightly different things to people and bam, that's what we got. Okay, now, but how can we have Jesus' teaching if Jesus taught in Aramaic and we've got Greek Gospels? Let's go to a romantic, Ernest Renan best-selling book on the life of Jesus in the 19th century, one of the best-selling. He says it's not probable that Jesus knew Greek. The language was very little spread in Judea beyond the classes who participated in the government and the towns inhabited by pagans like Caesarea. The real mother tongue of Jesus was the Syrian dialect mixed with Hebrew, which was then spoken in Palestine. Still less probably had he any knowledge of Greek culture. Now, this is a phenomenal statement, completely overturned by modern scholarship as we see how much Greek architecture and Greek culture and education there was within Palestine. But I want to say, actually, the Gospels give us evidence for Greek speaking. I mean, firstly, they are Greek Gospels. That's significant. We don't have Aramaic Gospels. Yes, we have reports of an early Hebrew Gospel, whatever that means. But they are Greek Gospels. And we know there are Greek speakers in the church in Jerusalem, Acts chapter 6. Two of Jesus' 12 disciples have Greek names, Andrew and Philip, but not only two. In fact, every single one of Jesus' disciples has a partially Greek name. Now, what I mean by that, and even the name Jesus is partially Greek. He's not ever called Yeshua in the early church. There's no evidence for that. He always is called Jesus. Every form we get has got the Greek ending. Every single one of those names is nativized. So whereas in Matthew chapter 1, we have Jacob for Jacob, but when we have Jesus' disciples, we have Jacobos with the Greek ending stuck onto the Hebrew name. Now, I'm not saying this means that they are fully Greek names, but I am saying as we get them in the form of the New Testament, they are nativized. Now, let's think about Andrew's family for a bit, because Andrew has this older brother called Simon. And the great thing about Simon is it works as a Greek version of Simeon, but also it's a native Greek name. And that's why it became one of the most popular names. In fact, the most popular name for a Palestinian Jewish male. But Andreas, the form here, not Andrus, Andreas, for Andrew, is a rare name for a Palestinian Jewish male. So his parents have chosen for their second son, and they may have had more, but at least the second we know about, a unusual Greek name. And we know from John's Gospel that Philip and Andrew both come from Bethsaida. We know that Bethsaida gets called a polis. And we know that Simon and Andrew are in business partnership with James and John. And we know that James and John have hired workers. And so when we start seeing there, we can see that even at the core cluster of some of Jesus' disciples, there is the potential for Greek speaking. Some people worry about John chapter 3 and say, how could Jesus say, be born again, if he's speaking in Aramaic to Nicodemus? And I say, well, have you considered the name Nicodemus? It's a Greek name. You know, the elites like to brush up to the overlords and use the language which goes well with them. You know, the soldiers around you and so on, they're not learning Aramaic to speak to you. They're not learning Hebrew to speak to you. So what we find is there are even wonderful names like Bartimaeus, Aramaic prefix meaning son of, and Timaeus, a name straight from Plato. And you think, wow, so just tell me about his grandparents, maybe liked Plato, and you know, what's going on there? So there are plenty of names which are Greek. When you look at, you know, the Aristobuluses and all the elites amongst Judaism, you find there's quite a lot of Greek name there. Even the core Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, is the Sanhedrion. To think of how the Jews use a Greek word for their own council. And Jesus is an itinerant preacher who commissions his disciples to be itinerant preachers. Well, guess what? When you're itinerant, you meet lots of people. And what do you have to do? You have to adapt to whatever language they're going to have in order to explain things. So therefore, this idea that the disciples are exclusive Aramaic speakers, led by an exclusive Aramaic speaker, is something I would want to challenge. As of course, that wonderful conversation where Jesus speaks to the Syrophoenician woman who is specifically said to be a Greek. Well, is he speaking Phoenician to her? No. Is he speaking Punic? No. Greek? Why not? So what we find is there are quite a number of examples where you could say that. Now, there's a wonderful case that a professor in Cambridge pointed out to me where people are worried in John's Gospel. Is Jesus going to go off and teach the Greeks? You remember that bit? Well, hang on. How can he do that if he don't speak no Greek? So what we find is this makes sense. Okay, I know there's a lot of irony in John. Those sort of things can go on. But it makes sense if he could speak Greek. Now, what about some actual positive evidence that he used Greek? Here, I present you the Bible. Beatitudes. Now, you all know the Matthean Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor. Poor begins with the letter pi, doesn't it? Poor, puh. Yeah? Blessed are the poor in spirit. The word spirit also begins with puh. Okay, sorry if I aspirate it. I know it's not meant to be aspirated, but that doesn't matter. Okay, for this purpose. Then blessed are those who mourn with a pie. Blessed are the meek with a pie. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness with a pie. Four in a row. Baptists, you love alliteration, don't you? This is your biblical mandate. Don't you let those people criticize you for your alliteration. This comes straight from the Bible. Now, worth coming just for that, wasn't it? Now, but it's not just that the first four begin like that. The first two each have a pie as they go on, so they shall be comforted. But then we go to Beatitude number four, bless those who hunger and thirst, dipsontes, D-I, for righteousness, dikaiosunen, D-I. The sixth one, bless those who pure, katharoi, catheter, you know, pure, right? In heart, cardia, cardiology. The final one, the eighth one, dedeomenoi, the reduplication of the delta there, then a di root going before righteousness. And by the way, isn't it great that some people see these four, these eight Beatitudes divided into two sets of four, both of which have this delta iota sound at the end of them? You say, well, what about the rest? Well, we can take care of those because number five, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy, has the mercy root repeated. And you say, aha, got you on verse 9. Number 7, blessed are those who are peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. And you say, there's nothing going on there. Oh, yes, there is. Because if you follow Randall Boo's system of pronunciation, he would say that omicron iota is pronounced oo, as in Scottish ochaide nu and French lune for moon and so on. It's like that. It's a front vowel. And in fact, the oo sound at the end of the peacemakers is identical in his mind, which he came up independently on his reconstructed pronunciation from this text and from me, with the word sons, which is ou. So if you actually take that seriously, you have all eight Beatitudes have got assonance, alliteration, and the rest of things. Now, it's not just that. It's also that we have, in the first and last Beatitudes, four theirs is, hoti auton, and in the second through to the seventh, hoti autoi. So the only difference we've got is the last two vowels for those. They're both long vowels in those situations. Then we find that five of them end with ontai in Greek, four of the five with thesontai, lovely passives. Then we find that all of the sigmatic plurals, the sigmas, have been grouped together in the middle, and all of the omicron iota plurals are at the beginning or the end. Now, what's going on here? Well, it could be that Matthew is signaling, by the way, Jesus didn't say any of this, but I've made something that really alliterates a lot. Or is he actually presenting Jesus as speaking Greek? Well, go back a couple of verses before the sermon, Matthew chapter 4, verse 24, 25, and you find that his fame spreads throughout all Syria, and great crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, yeah, that's where there's Greek, and from Jerusalem and Judea and beyond the Jordan. Now, probably where he is, often thought to be, is in the Galilee. And so you could have that these groups are named basically relative to the amount of distance they have to travel to be there. But what sense would it make to strike up to a load of people from the Decapolis in Aramaic? You know, I'm going to speak my Galilean Aramaic. Are you going to understand me? It's not going to work, is it? Yes, I came from the north of England. Can do that if you like. Now, here's a colleague of mine in Cambridge, wonderful Dr. James Aitken, who's an expert on the Greek Old Testament. He actually says alliteration with pi was a standard device in writers, and he gives some documentation for this. You say, well, could it work in another language? Like, could it work in Hebrew? So here we are, we're just using, there are various translations of Matthew's gospel into Hebrew. We'll just pick up one of them. And one of the things we notice, of course, is if we go to the right-hand word, which is asherei, blessed are, then we find what follows after that varies depending on whether it's going to have the definite article or not. Very little decent alliteration going on in the entire thing. There's a bit of alliteration between number one and three, the poor in spirit and those who are meek. They both begin ayin nun, but that's not a lot. And then we say, well, what about if we put it into Aramaic? So here, I rather than make my own Aramaic example, I'm picking the Syriac. Now, there might be one or two of you who don't read Syriac, that's fine. It goes right to left. So the right-hand word on those eight examples is blessed are. Then the very next letter is simply lamed, meaning it's a preposition to. So that's not telling you that actually they all begin the same way. And you look at it and you say, how much alliteration do you have going on in these? And the answer is hardly any. And then you look at the second clause and you realize that in Greek you can do hoti autoi for they, and you switch it out for hoti auton for theirs, and you have to change almost nothing. But if you want to do the same in Greek and Aramaic, you're going to have to switch the whole syntax round to get that. So in other words, these things work beautifully in Greek. Now, it's not just that you have that. You go on through the sermon and you see so much. Jesus famously in 5 verse 13 says, you are the salt of the earth, and if the salt has lost its taste. And then you see this word, moranthe, for has lost its taste. But this Greek word normally means become stupid. And when you look in the dictionaries like BDAG for why it means lose its taste, they refer you to Matthew Black's Aramaic approach to the Gospels for this text to give you the meaning that they want. But if we just do normal lexicography and say, where else do we have this meaning? We would say it means the salt has become stupid. And it works in Greek because salt is to do with cleverness and wit and so on. You continue, and Jesus says, you are the light of the world, cosmos. And a city is not able to be hidden, krubenai with a kappa, and it kemene lies on top of a mountain. Nor do they light with a kappa, and let's go on to lambda now. They a light luchnon, but that's, they put it on a luchnia, a lampstand, and then it can lampe, shine in line three if you lost that, and then it shine line four and so on. You go through and you find in chapter six, Jesus says, if your eye is haplus, unusual Greek word, which in the ESV is translated, if your eye is healthy, and if the King James is, if therefore thine eye be single. And we look at the Vulgate and you see your oculus tuus simplex, single. Well, what's going on there? We actually need it to mean healthy, and we need it to be single because the health is connected with only having eye for one thing, not your eye on wealth and so on. So in fact, we need both meanings, and it works so well in Greek. Then we have this amazing one in chapter 6, verse 27. Which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? Or, in the King James, one cubit unto his stature. Well, is it length of time or height? The answer is this, yes. Because the ASV does it most literally, one cubit unto the measure of his life. And what you see is, straight afterwards, we've got the lilies growing physically, so we want the height stuff. And then two verses later, the grass is short-lived, so we want the life stuff. We want both, and it works beautifully in Greek. We go on to chapter 6. Now, just look at this beautiful alpha cluster. I mean, this is really alpha stuff. Chapter 6, verses 30 to 35. To everyone who asks with an alpha, give. And from with an alpha, the one who takes your things, don't ask with an alpha back. And it just goes on out. Alphas all the way. You see those, yeah? So, what's that? 10 significant lexemes beginning with alpha. Give you a list there. 110 words. 22% beginning with alpha, 40% of nouns, verbs, and adjectives. So quite a lot. Then Jesus comes to chapter 7. Do not judge that you be not judged. For with other judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with whatever you measured, it will be measured to you. Well, that's not quite as snappy as the Greek, is it? Mer kriniter, do not judge. Hina, that's the hinge on which things go. Mer kritheter, you may not be judged. There's a perfect balance in those first five words. And then we go to this. In the judgment that you judge, you will be judged. And what we see is K-R-I, kri, 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 three in a row. In the judgment you, krimeti, kriniter, krithesis there. And the same with measure, beginning M-E-T. Met, 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 metro, metrete, metrethesitai. Now you try and do that in Aramaic, I've given you the Syriac at the bottom, and what you find is it doesn't work because you end up having to put prefixes onto the three-letter root in the Aramaic, and you're changing the internal vowel structure. It simply doesn't work. Doesn't work in English, doesn't work in Aramaic, doesn't work in Hebrew, but hey, it works in Greek beautifully. And so what we see is this is all evidence, I think, of a Greek sermon. You look at Matthew chapter 7. So every good tree bears good fruit. And carpus calus. You just hear the assonance here. What does the other one does? It does ponerus poie. It makes bad ones. Ooh, dunatai dendron. A tree is not able. By the way, you know dendron is just our word tree with a few sound changes in, but it's tree, dendron. You see, it's got reduplication, hence two Ds. That's just etymology. Anyway, don't worry about that. And what you see is if it doesn't do good fruits, carpus calus, then you have to chop it down and it gets ekoptetai with a kappa. Now, I can show you a little bit more. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11. I know we're jumping back, but I wanted to do this to show it in relation to 7, verse 15. Blessed are you when they upbraid you and persecute and say, with a pie in, all evil things with a pie, falsely, beginning with a P, falsely, because that's what they did to the prophets with a P, pro, who are before you, pro you. Then we get later on with prophets, prosekete, look out for with a pro, from Sion's false prophets, they will come to you like, in sheep's clothing, probatone. Now, come on, guys, can you see quantitatively, you start to get a sense that this is really something going on here, and everyone, a lot of people have been ignoring what's in here. I don't want to say everyone. Now, you say, okay, so Matthew does that. No, it's the same pattern in Luke. Now, remember, Matthew has got eight Beatitudes, and Luke has four Beatitudes and four woes. So we know that Luke doesn't get all the stuff from Matthew, and Matthew doesn't get all the stuff from Luke. But when we look at the way the equivalent sermon is in Luke, we find blessed are the poor, with the first P. Oh, by the way, I think there's a good reason that you don't think that poor in spirit was added redactionally, because actually there's a system of pies running through these. It's not that bit was added. Blessed are the poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, again with a pie. Then we don't have so much pie, but you've got your reward will be much pie. Heaven, that's what they did, pie. The prophets, your fathers did some pies. Then we've got a couple of words we could use for but why not use the but word plan, which begins with a pie, and say, but woe to you rich pie, for you have with a bit of a pie in, your reward pie. Woe to you who are double pied, filmed, you know, empeplasmenoi, because you will pie hunger. Woe to those who laugh now, because you will mourn pie. And what you find is, woe to you when all speak well of you with a pie in the middle, because all with a pie, that's what they did. They epoioned. Who did? The false prophets. Your fathers did that to the false prophets. In other words, you see all of this going on. And so my thought is this. It's not that we have a source called Q. It's a source called P. And what I mean by that is that how do you explain that both Matthew and Luke have this? You explain it by saying that they are drawing on a common well of memory. And you can't say, well, Luke has put in the plan there, because actually there are other ones which people see as non-redactional. So in fact, it all fits together. Then you look at how does Luke do the judging bit? Do not judge and you will not be judged. So it's not so that you don't be judged, it's and you will not be judged. And do not condemn with a kappa, and you will not be condemned with a kappa. So in other words, it's the same type of pattern you've got in the two Gospels. It's not the same wording. One hasn't got it from the other. It's the same mindset, compositional mindset, which is running through. And then you see this beautiful bit about, you know, it will be shaken down and trodden down. It's going to be so full. And whatever measure you measure with, and make sure you put those two together, that's good. But by the way, make sure a blind person is not able to lead a blind person, and put the two blind people together, tuflos tuflon, it's exactly the same as you've done with measure. So in other words, the compositional techniques are the same. And I want to suggest to you simply that what we have here is one mind. So when we look at the Gospels, obviously we know John doesn't have parables, at least not of the type that you have elsewhere. But parables are an unusual thing. There are only maybe a couple in the Old Testament, none in the Apocrypha or Dead Sea Scrolls. They're rare in the early church. Rabbis have a few. I mean, they add up, but there is like a few per rabbi, not a massive number you have with Jesus. So, and then we look at the themes that you have of kingdom and of Son of Man. You start saying the easiest, the simplest, the most beautiful explanation is Jesus originates this teaching, and it then goes out in these different sources, rather than saying, I have to have these things. You know, Luke has to be a brilliant inventor of stories, and Matthew a brilliant inventor of stories, and so on. We look at the hard sayings that Jesus comes out with in all four Gospels. Why would later Christians make up things like basically do what the Pharisees say? Why would they have Jesus dying, calling out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so on. You can look at some of the beautiful geography you get where Jesus calls out, woe to Capernaum, woe to Bethsaida, and by the way, woe to you, Capernaum. And then you look at where they are and you say, well, look, Capernaum's here by the sea. If I could go in a helicopter, Chorazin would be, you know, a couple of miles away, but I actually have to go round. And Bethsaida is very close. How do people know these things are so close unless they're really familiar with the geography? Now let's get into some exegesis because, you know, we haven't done enough Bible text yet. So I want us to start on Luke chapter 15 and 16. You may want it open with you. So you remember Jesus tells this story, a certain man had two sons, but it's not the only time he tells a story that says a certain man had two sons. He also tells exactly the same sort of story, the same beginning in Matthew chapter 21. You know, he says to one, go out in the vineyard, and he says, I will not, changes his mind, and the other one does the opposite. And then Jesus concludes verse 32 that tax collectors and prostitutes believed and they're coming into the kingdom ahead of you. Now, what's so striking is that Jesus, when you look at something like the parable of the two sons, I would say to you, every single Greek word counts in that story. There is no redundancy. It is brilliant composition. Either I'm going to say that Luke or whoever wrote Luke's gospel came up with a brilliant composition and gave away and credited all his intellectual property to his master who hadn't really come up with very much. Or I'm going to say, no, the master did it. And it's a far better explanation. Well, what we see within Luke is that we have an amazing structure that falls across chapters 15 to 16. You see, in the parable of the two sons, you find that the younger son, who seems to be the bad guy, every time he talks to his father or thinks in his head about what he's going to say to his father, calls him father. The very first word that the older brother says is, look, all these years I've been slaving for you. So he doesn't think of him as father. Now that's really interesting, because when we go a couple of parables on, we're going to see in the rich man and Lazarus that the rich man keeps on calling Abraham his father. But the problem is the rich man is not very good at mathematics, because he thinks that he's just got five brothers. But hang on, if Abraham is your father, you've got more than five brothers, haven't you? Duh. So, you know, Lazarus is your brother. So that, and the five books of Moses would have told you had more than five brothers if you just thought about it for a little while. But anyway, so what you find is those things are happening right in the middle. Now, Jesus tells you a certain man had two sons, and one of them, you know, went off and he wasted things. The very next story, chapter 16, verse 1, is the story of the unjust manager who's accused of wasting. So you've got two stories about wasting money adjacent to each other, being overheard by people who are really into money. Okay, you look at chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, and you have the tax collectors and sinners there, and you also have the scribes and the Pharisees. So there are some top Bible class people there. And what we see is then in chapter 15 that the young man whose son who's run away is longing for the food that the pigs are eating, or even the remainder of that. And then we have in chapter 16 that Lazarus is longing for the stuff that's falling from the table. Then in the parable of the prodigal son, the guy comes to himself and says, well, how many of my father's hired servants have enough? And then, you know, in the next parable, the unjust steward, it's how much you owe. It's exactly the same phrase. Then we find the prodigal son addresses himself. That's exactly what the unjust steward does. Then what we see is that the father saw the younger son afar off. And in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man, who's unnamed because he's important on earth but not important afterwards, he sees Abraham afar off. Now, Jesus did things a bit like Pixar. You know, Pixar do their kids' movies and they also throw in stuff for the adults. Well, Jesus taught simply for everyone, but he also threw stuff in for the top of the class. And if you know your Old Testament well enough, you know that the guy who lifts up his eyes and sees the most in the Old Testament is Abraham. And there's one time he looks up his eyes and sees afar off the mountain, Moriah, chapter 22. And so it's just amazing that Jesus, who is clearly a very, very deep student of the Bible, he didn't get his Bible knowledge through the shortcut of, oh, I'm just going to press divine omniscience. He worked at this. I'd want to argue. He really studied things very closely, and he throws these things in for the top of the class. Whether they got it or not, we don't know. The prodigal son comes back, and the first word of the father is quickly. Oh, time's been passing so slowly for the father, but now there is no time to lose. That's, of course, exactly the same word that the unjust steward says. Quickly, sit down, change the bill. Then the father is charging that everyone should celebrate. But that's what the rich man's been doing every single day. And it's an amazing thing, because you think, okay, Xerxes had a feast for half a year, but there's only one guy in the Bible who is connected with people who feast every day, and that's Job's children, isn't it? They feast every day. And by the way, he's rich and he gets covered with sores just like Lazarus. And you start seeing the layers of genius here. And you think, well, who comes up with this? Who is Luke to come up with this? Or are we not going to say that our Lord, the Master Jesus Christ, came up with this sort of stuff? Then we have that the older brother comes back and he calls one of the servants. Calling one of the servants, exactly, proskalosamenos hena in Greek, is exactly the same phrase that we have going on in the parable of the unjust steward. What's the oldest brother want? He wants goat. No, he doesn't want goat. He's been having plenty of goats. He says, you never gave me goats. By the way, you own the whole farm, older brother. You never gave me goats so that I could celebrate with my friends. Very important. Who's on the guest list for the older brother is the older brother's friends and not the father. You see, if the father was there, it wouldn't be such fun, would it? Now, what we find is that the same thing in the next parable is about getting friends with unjust mammon. And then the address of the father to the older brother at the end is child, exactly the same as Abraham, to the rich man. And of course, those two parables begin, there was a rich man, there's a rich man. Now, what I want us to notice here is there is another level as well. Because who's the most famous person in the Old Testament with two and only two sons? Well, it's Isaac, isn't it? And the whole background to this is utilizing the Jacob-Esau story, because the younger brother cheeks the older out of inheritance, which this older brother in Luke 15 thinks he might lose a bit of his inheritance. And the younger brother goes off into a far country with nothing, looks after sheep, and then comes back with lots. And of course, this is the opposite. The older brother, Esau, in Genesis, is a man of the field, as is this older brother here. The father, Isaac, wants meat, and that's exactly what the older brother here wants. And the younger brother also really desires food. Oh, that wonderful thing, please come near me, of Genesis 27. And of course, he drew near to the house. And Esau wants his father dead, as it seems does the older brother. But the really striking thing is this, that the father runs and meets the younger brother, doesn't he? And where is the only place in the entire Bible where someone runs and throws their arm around someone and kisses them? It's Esau meeting Jacob. This is phenomenal. If you know, because you can read this story at the surface level and you can read it at the top level for the scribes. And Jesus has the genius that put this all together. And suddenly you think, whoa, Esau's a really bad guy who had lost his entire inheritance and he forgave Jacob. And here I'm an older brother just worrying about, you know, younger brother just having a bit of regular food in our farm. Think about it. Yeah, except the tax collectors and sinners. Don't think, oh no, they're going to take our rights and so on. I mean, there's so many implications to this today, aren't there? But there's another level to this. And that is, it's also the background of the Jacob Laban story, where in Jacob and Laban, the daughters say to Laban, he's indeed devoured our money. And the older brother says he's devoured your property, by the way, with prostitutes. And I think, how on earth did you get that older bro? Because it's not as if he was sending postcards back saying, hey, here I am down at the brothel. The only way he can get the information about the prostitutes is from his imagination. That's the only way. And yet that way it's in his imagination is because that's where he wanted to be. So then you look at Laban says, hey, I could have sent you on your way with mirth and songs. And of course, the music and dancing there in Luke. These 20 years I've been waiting for you, says Jacob. All these many years I've served you, says the older brother. All that you see is mine, says Laban. All this is mine is yours, says the father. If anyone does want this PowerPoint afterwards, that's fine. I mean, most of it's on Twitter anyway. Now, where do I come with this? Pigs and dogs. You see, in Luke 15, the younger brother goes out to feed pigs. In Luke 16, Lazarus is licked by dogs. And they're unclean animals. But who talks about pigs and dogs elsewhere? Well, it's in Matthew where Jesus talks about it. So in other words, what we find is this is the mind. This is the mind of Jesus given to us in the scriptures, and we can be really confident that these things are correctly expressed. The simple explanation is the same mind is responsible for the parables. The same mind deeply steeped in the Old Testament. The same mind makes every word of a parable count. The same mind has the same themes, the reversal, the unclean animals, the bringing of the marginalized. Well, you say, well, what if Jesus taught in Aramaic? That's fine. I'm not saying Jesus didn't teach in Aramaic. But look at this. If he did teach in Aramaic, there was loads of Greek in Aramaic. Because after that guy, Alexander the Big, great, you know, went around conquering places, people had lots of Greek. And so I've given you lots of Greek words there. I don't know whether you can see them or not. Where they occur in Matthew's gospel, just on Matthew on this. And where you have those Greek words in Aramaic dialects and a whole load of dialects where they occur. And here's another case. There are 8 times that Jesus has Latin words within his Greek text, quite a few of them in Matthew, several of them relating to coins and administration and so on. Every single one of those Latin words was not only in Greek, it was also in Aramaic because it had traveled so far. So in other words, I don't mind whether he's speaking Greek or speaking Aramaic or whether they're doing simultaneous translation or they're just getting by the way people get by in multilingual settings. I'm not doctrinaire about saying, you know, he only taught in Greek or he only taught in Aramaic. I'm saying, look, people in multilingual settings get by. So whether he prepares his sermon in Greek, whether he edits a version in Greek, whether it's simultaneously translated, an authorized translation, I don't really care and I don't know and I don't think we have the data to know. But what I can say is there's every reason to think that things have been thoroughly, carefully handed down to us. So we have lines of mutually reinforcing evidence for the teachings of Jesus. He was an itinerant preacher who went round in a multilingual setting. Provided we don't hold the gospel writers to an anachronistic rule of quotation, there's no reason to posit a big gap between what they wrote and what he said. Thank you.